Thank you for everyone coming out today. Great to see this kind of attendance. Welcome people. We have visitors from our lawyers chapter at the Federalist Society today too. If anyone's feeling cramped, we do have this event being simulcast into 270 next door. If you'd like to go next door, it's a little more comfortable. The Federalist Society. Whether loved or hated, most everyone in the legal profession knows our name. The Federalist Society is a nonpartisan, conservative, libertarian organization dedicated to fostering balanced and open debate about the fundamental principles of freedom, federalism, and judicial restraint. The Federalist Society seeks to educate the legal community through its programs and publications about how limited constitutional government based on the rule of law can have a positive effect on law and public policy. But how many, yes, even among our membership, know about the origin of our organization's title? What is federalism? Was there ever any alternative in the American founding? Was our Constitution federal? If so, does it remain federal? Would it have been better off following more anti-federalist principles? To address this issue, as always, we turn to the experts. Joining us today for an informative debate is Dr. Mickey Craig and Professor Patrick Gillen. Representing federalism, Dr. Mickey Craig is Dean of Social Sciences and the William and Bernice Grucock Professor of Politics and Associate Professor of Political Science at Hillsdale College, where he has taught since 1986. He holds a PhD and MA in Political Science from Claremont Graduate School and a BA from Arkansas State University. He is a happily married father of six. Representing anti-federalism is Ave Maria's own Professor Patrick Gillen, where he is Assistant Professor of Law here at Ave Maria. He holds a JD and PhD in American History from the University of Notre Dame, a Master's in American History from Fordham University, and a Bachelor of Arts from Providence College. He's a former judicial clerk for the Judge Robert D. Potter of the United States District Court for the Western District of North Carolina and Judge Daniel A. Mannion of the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, both of whom, he is pleased to report, are staunch supporters of the Federalist Society. Professor Gillen has 16 years of experience in civil litigation and has focused his practice on civil rights and civil liberties, including freedom of speech and religion. He also drafted the operative language of Michigan's marriage amendment, which the Michigan Supreme Court held to bar the recognition of same-sex domestic partnerships in the National Pride at Work versus Granholm case, a decision rendered last May, when Clifford Taylor was still serving as Chief Justice. The Chief Justice voted with the majority of votes, for which Professor Gillen hopes to thank him in person now that Justice Taylor has joined our faculty. Before we begin, please join me in welcoming both of our speakers. The debate will proceed in the following format. Each side will have 15 minutes to present their opening arguments. Each side will then have 5 minutes for rebuttal, followed by a question-and-answer period from the audience. It's only fair, as we are a federalist society, that Dr. Craig, representing federalism, goes first. Good afternoon, everyone. It's wonderful to be here at Ave Maria College. It's wonderful to be speaking at a Federalist Society event. If I can say just a couple of thank yous before I get started. I'm not a member of the Federalist Society. I'm not a lawyer. I do believe the Federalist Society is the most effective organization in the country for keeping the debate alive about what the Constitution means in our public life, or ought to mean in our public life. And the reason we have 4 good justices on the Supreme Court and 3 good justices on the Michigan Supreme Court is in large measure due to the efforts of the Federalist Society. I'm also very happy to say I teach at Hillsdale College, and I feel like Hillsdale College and Ave Maria were sort of sister colleges or brother colleges fighting against all the political correctness out there. And it's a good thing to see some of my former students here. We have a lot of wonderful students at Hillsdale. We send someone to Ave Maria. You perform miracles here, so I have hopes that even Mr. Klein might learn something his three years here. My job today is to spend 15 minutes setting up an argument about the Federalists. Who are the Federalists in the first place? The Federalists are the people who argued for the ratification of the Constitution after the Constitution Convention was completed on September 17, 1787. So the two main Federalists that I want to talk about are Alexander Hamilton and James Madison.
they are the main authors of the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers are a series of 85 newspaper articles, op-ed pieces, written by Madison, Hamilton, and Jay in the course of the winter of 1787 and 1788, trying to persuade the voters of New York, especially, to vote for delegates who would vote to ratify the Constitution at the New York State Ratifying Convention. So what I want to do, I want to make two very simple, quick points about the Federalist Papers, about the Federalist understanding of politics and republicanism, and ultimately constitutionalism. And the first one is just to ask a very simple question, and that is, why did we get to the point where we thought we needed to call a constitutional convention? Why did we need to get rid of the Articles of Confederation and set up a new constitution? Now, you have a little one-page handout that I hope everybody got a copy of that. I want to look at a couple of things at the very top of the front page there. On February 21st, 1787, the Congress, under the Articles of Confederation, declared itself unable to act. Okay, this is a very rare thing for a government to do, to say that we're incompetent, we're not able to act, and to call for a constitutional convention and say we need to reform the Articles of Confederation. So what sorts of things were going on that led them to this conclusion? The basic point is this. The members of Congress and the Articles, the leading political figures in the country in the 1780s, slowly but surely came to the conclusion that the Articles of Confederation were not an adequate government for preserving liberty. Now George Washington, Alexander Hamilton had come to this conclusion around 1779, 1780, even before the Articles had been ratified. They were arguing that Congress, the national government under the Articles, did not have an adequate power to raise revenue and then provide the common defense, regulate commerce, and do the things that we expected the national government to do. So that was the main problem, was that the Articles of Confederation, when they made an attempt to raise revenue, all they were allowed to do was to make requisitions on the states. And if the states didn't comply with that requisition, there was no revenue for the national government. So for years, the members of the army did not get paid for the work they were doing in the field, trying to win our independence from Great Britain. After the war was over, this continued. Under the Articles, we were unable to provide an effective common defense. Just give you one example. After the peace treaty with Great Britain in 1783, the Brits continued to occupy the forts on the Ohio River that they had agreed to abandon, but there was nothing we could do about it. And most importantly, as the 1783, 1784, as things went along, we were unable to not so much pay off the debt that we had incurred in the war, we were unable to even pay the interest on the debt. Okay, so we couldn't raise our revenue for that either. Going on in the states, various things were going on that were leading to problems as well. The state legislatures, several state legislatures would pass statutes suspending the obligations of contracts. So majorities were interfering with the obligations of contracts. State governments were entering into commercial treaties with foreign countries. State governments were doing all sorts of things. And this led to various tumults or riots, disorder in the country, culminating in Shays' Rebellion in Western Massachusetts in late 1786. So those are the sorts of things that were going on. And basically what it led James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Washington, the people who are considered the leading Federalists in the country, to say the liberty of this country is threatened because the national government is too weak. I think that's the first point, is that liberty is threatened by two opposites in James Madison's understanding. Liberty is threatened when government is too powerful. Obviously, There's tyranny. Government's doing things it ought not do. But government, liberty is also threatened when government is too weak, when there's anarchy, chaos, inadequate protection for property, no stability in the society, and government can't stand up to these criminal predators or the various tumults that are going on in the country. So what occurs then when the government calls for a constitutional convention, the convention was called simply to reform and amend the Articles of Confederation. But to make a long story short, when the convention convened, James Madison and other members of the Constitutional Convention persuaded the delegates to the Constitutional Convention that the Articles of Confederation are so defective that they can't be reformed, and we need to throw it out and write a whole new Constitution. Now, if you look on the back page of my little handout here, at the bottom of the second page there, I have an outline of the Federalist Papers. And if you look under Papers 15 to 22, you have seven or eight Federalist Papers, where Madison and Hamilton lay out all the defects of the Articles of Confederation, why they're inadequate to the purposes of union, republicanism, and liberty. Okay? And so we have to have a new constitution. And the main thing we have to have in the new Constitution is an adequate provision for the national government to be able to raise revenue. Okay? There's an agreement between the Federalists and Anti-Federalists. The agreement is the national government is supposed to provide for the common defense. The national government is supposed to regulate commerce, ensure domestic tranquility. So all the things you see in the preamble to the Constitution, you also see in the Articles of Confederation as purposes of the national government. The disagreement between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists is what is the most effective way, what are the proper means of accomplishing those ends. And so what the Constitution does that the Articles of Confederation doesn't do, one of the things it does, is it gives to the national government the power to tax individuals. This is a very dangerous power, right? But it's a power that the Federalists argue a free people has to trust with the power. If you expect someone to do something, you have to give them the ability to perform that job. If you expect the national government to perform the common defense, to provide the common defense, we have to give them the ability to raise the revenue so they can build the army, pay the army to provide the common defense. So that's step number one. And step number one, the founders and the Federalists view is that in order to preserve liberty, we have to have a more energetic national government than the one provided by the Articles of Confederation. If we have a strong national government, we will preserve the Union rather than break up into separate confederacies. If we preserve the Union, that will serve our foreign policy interests. It will make it easier for us to remain independent from Europe, France, Prussia, Spain, and England. It will also lead to domestic prosperity in their understanding. Protection against the states interfering with the obligations of contracts. In effect, the Constitution, one aspect of the Constitution is that it's really the creation of the first free trade zone in the United States. It will be a free trade zone between the states. So it's going to be in our foreign policy interest and our domestic policy interest to do this, and we have to give to the national government this power to tax. So the question becomes, in the course of the debate, the question then becomes, if you're going to make a stronger national government, how do we prevent that government itself from becoming tyrannical? Okay? How do we prevent, we're going to give this power to the national government. We're going to have these people serving 2-year terms, 6-year terms, 4-year terms, and judges. Federal judges are going to serve life terms during good behavior. How do we prevent the national government from becoming a tyranny itself, developing an interest of its own contrary to the interests of the people? And my argument is that the most valuable contribution that the Federalists make to American political thought is their defense of the republicanism of the Constitution and their explanation of how the Constitution preserves liberty by getting a government that's sufficiently energetic to do what it does, but it sets up a government that will remain limited as long as we remain true to the practices of the Constitution itself. So I'm going to look at two or three passages here, and what I want to try to set up is this. Okay. What is it in James Madison's mind, the father of the Constitution, and in Alexander Hamilton's mind, and in George Washington's mind, and John Jay's mind, what is it that the Constitution accomplishes that no other popular government has ever accomplished in world history? That's what they think they've done. If they can persuade the people to ratify this Constitution, they will set up a popular form of government unlike any other in history. So look on the handout. Again, this is on the front side here. We'll look on the first page here. There are two things they're going to try to accomplish. Okay. If you look at the quotation, it's about not quite down the middle of the page there from Federalist Paper number 10. Madison writes, "When a majority is included in a faction, the form of popular government enables it to sacrifice to its ruling passion or interest both the public good and the rights of other citizens. To secure the public good and private rights against the danger of such a faction, a majority faction, a majority tyranny, and at the same time to preserve the spirit and form of popular government is then the great object to which our inquiries are directed." So what Publius, what Madison is arguing here is that what we're going to do is we're going to have a form of majority rule, republicanism, but the way we put together majorities will make it less likely that that majority will become tyrannical and that we will have majority rule that is consistent with justice. Justice is the end of government, Federalist Paper number 51 says. So we're going to have republicanism. We can't have democracy. Democracy leads to majority tyranny. Okay. Republicanism is the solution. And so the two chief characteristics of the Constitution, what the bulk of the Federalist Papers defend, is the idea of separation of powers, three separate branches of government, and federalism. You didn't think I was going to say the word, right? Federalism. Decentralized power. So we're going to separate powers horizontally and vertically in a way that makes it impossible or makes it less likely that there will be a concentration of power that might lead to tyranny. So let's look at the next quotation there on Federalist Paper number 47. This is the sort of second thing that the founders are after. "The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny." And so what the founders have to, what they're saying is if we're going to avoid tyranny, we have to avoid the consolidation of power into one place. We have to divide power. It's very possible if we put the hands, if we put all power in the hands of the majority and all power in the hands of the legislature, that will become tyrannical. So we have to have a genuine separation of powers where each branch of government is independent from the other branch of government and can stand up to the encroachments of each branch of government. They will, ambition will be made to counteract ambition, as Federalist Paper number 51 says, and each branch will check one another. Then each level of government is going to check the encroachments of the other level of government. The state governments are going to check the national governments are going to check the state governments. Now, let me give, I've got 1 minute left in my 15 minutes, but let me just give you one example of how the founders expected that to work. The quotation from Federalist 14 and 62 at the bottom. Number 414 simply says, "In effect, we have divided sovereignty in this country. The national government is a government of enumerated powers. We're giving it the authority to do, we're giving it the energy to do the few things we expect the national government to do. All of the power is retained by the state governments and the people." That becomes echoed in the 10th Amendment. Now, how do you make that work? Federalist Paper number 62 says, real quickly here, "In this spirit, it may be remarked that the equal vote allowed to each state in the Senate is at once a constitutional recognition of the portion of sovereignty remaining in individual states and an instrument of preserving that sovereignty." Okay. I ask permission for 30 more seconds.
I yield that.
Thank you, Mr. Professor. I'll do the same. What's going on in number 62 is a very simple thing. If you think about the Constitution as a political body, as an edifice, as a piece of architecture, how were U.S. senators originally chosen? By state legislatures, okay? So the fact that state legislatures choose U.S. senators means that when U.S. senators debate about making a law, one of the things that enters into their deliberation is, where do we get the authority to make this law? But will this authority encroach on the rights of the states? And if it will, then they'll say, well, you know, the state legislatures will not like this thing. So what you have in the Constitution, state legislatures choosing U.S. senators, the Electoral College, you have institutional devices through which and by which the various levels of government and institutions of governments are able to check one another and to prevent the government from becoming tyrannical, even though you've made it more energetic. Okay, let me stop there and turn it over to Professor Gilman.
I knew when Professor Craig and I were called to do this that 15 minutes would not be enough, but I'll take a stab at it too. I'll tell you, the occasion, first of all, I want to say that appearing next to him from Hillsdale, I share his sentiments that we're sister institutions in terms of our commitment to the best values of the American experiment and the truth, ultimately, the truth. So that's a pleasure for me. I want you to know that this occasion has been a one of great solace for me because, you know, I've been busy lately. I finally yesterday had a chance to sit down and collect my thoughts on the matter. And, you know, I went to bed last night and I had a dream, more of a nightmare. I thought that in my dream I'd wake up in the morning and that I'd turn on the TV and hear the news. And I'd learned that the President of the United States was about to sign a bill that was $786 billion worth of spending. And, you know, despite all the concern for stimulus, it seems to me there's not one whit of actual, genuine stimulus in there. Rather, it seems that this money, which we don't have and for which I will be taxed, is going to be paid out along partisan political lines that are designed to entrench the power of a corrupted party in power. And, you know, I began to panic. I began to think, this is like taxation without representation, in fact. This is what we had a revolution over. I was in my dream, I'm running up the stairs to grab my shotgun. Swarms! And then all of a sudden, a voice appeared from the heavens and it said, Pat, don't worry. This is James Madison. Remember, our government is one of limited and enumerated powers. If somebody pinched me, I'm not sure I'm awake. Because the federal system that was first foreseen by the founders plainly is honored in our day and age often more in the breach than the observance. So I want to give you some, you know, initial thoughts about the anti-federalists, their contribution to the founding, and what they might have to say to us today. You know, when Steve and Josh first approached me and said, would you like to do it? I said, by the way, you'd be the anti-federalist. I thought, great. So I've got the losing side of the debate, a group that's frequently associated with states' rights, slavery, and secession. And I'm opposing a guy from Hillsdale College who's going to know what he's talking about. It doesn't seem fair. So, at any rate, though, for the sake of the discussion and helping us all learn a little bit more about the founding, I thought I would participate. Let me say a few things. First, in terms of historiography, I think our debate is timely because there's a real sense in which the anti-federalists are just starting to get their due. If you look at them from the standpoint of the Whig history that characterized history for the first probably 100 or so years of American history, they were neglected as the narrow-minded people who couldn't see the compass of our national greatness, who opposed the founding document that became the instrument for us to achieve that national and then international destiny. They were sort of left in the dustbin of history with the notion that, you know, that it was just deserved. But they've been slowly rehabilitated, and interest in them has increased over the years, and I think for good reason. They were sort of rehabilitated by indirection in the 1930s when Beard offered an economic interpretation of the Constitution. He was so bent on making out the Federalists as a greedy property class bent on using the federal government to preserve property at the expense of the common good, that he couldn't help but make the anti-federalist stock go up. Subsequently, people have looked at that and said, well, that can't quite be right. There were property people on both sides of the line. Who were they? What were the values that animated them? Initial looks after Beard said, well, they seem to be more democratic, more agrarian. Others came along and said, well, not so democratic. Some of them were very elitist. And, you know, in that way, they were men of little faith in a democracy and certainly a national democracy. More recently, David Seymour has helped us see that, well, anti-federalists, like most political parties in our day, it's really a group of people with a variety of different sets of values that were united principally with opposition to the federal constitution. And he said, still, you know, if we look at them, we could say they're sort of elitist anti-federalists, the more middling strain, and then sort of virulent anti-federalists, which we think of as radical Democrats, I think, in our day. So are we to pity them or not? What is their contribution to the legacy? Here's some of the things I think we need to bear in mind when we think of the anti-federalists. First of all, we've got to remember that from their opposition to the federal constitution, they were first and foremost patriots. These were people who had supported the revolution and the American experiment. They supported the notion of a great American nation, but they opposed the federal constitution. That's because they were committed to a union of the states. To their mind, it was the people in the states that had won hard-fought liberty for the people of the nation. And the states, precisely because they were closer to and more responsive to their citizens, were the best guarantee of that illustrious future going forward. They were men who did love liberty, but saw the states as the vehicle to protect it, a better vehicle than a distant federal government. And they loved limited government. They agreed. In fact, one of the things that you're struck with when you look at this discussion is just how much commonality there was in many ways between the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. They believed in limited government. That's a government that leaves liberty with the people, protects their property and liberty so that they can pursue their own vision of happiness to the extent consistent with the common good. For that reason, they did endorse the notion of a written constitution seen as an additional safeguard to liberty on top of the natural law. And there were also men who placed a high value on civic virtue and religion as the ultimate repository of our liberty, the best guarantee of our national greatness. There were men who believed in the rule of law, and therefore, when they lost the struggle over the Constitution, they went along, acquiesced to the will of the people, expressed through the votes in favor of ratification. They were, in a word, founders of our country, every bit as important as the Federalists themselves, and their lasting legacy and proof of that was the addition of the Bill of Rights to the Constitution, probably the singular hallmark contribution that the Anti-Federalists can be properly credited with. I think that the bad rap that the Anti-Federalists had for quite a period of our national history started with the name-calling. That is to say that early on, their opponents, the Federalists, succeeded in branding them Anti-Federalists. It turns out, from the standpoint of the day, actually, the Anti-Federalists were the Federalists. But in the intervening period that Professor Craig has described, those who became advocates for a stronger federal government ended up portraying their position as one for a consolidation of authority in the federal government, and so took to themselves the name Federalist, leaving the Anti-Federalist with an unlucky and somewhat negative name. But remember, for the Anti-Federalist, they thought the revolution had produced a genuine federation. The people in the states had fought for and guaranteed liberty. They saw no reason why the people in the states wouldn't be capable of preserving it. And they looked at the plan to consolidate sovereign power at the national level as smacking of the unitary sovereignty of the king and parliament that they had just struggled so mightily to free themselves from. They were, to some extent, in favor of a stronger national government. They just wanted the accretions of power to the federal sovereignty to be more modest. They were willing to give it some taxing power, but wanted it to be subject to checks by the states. Whether that could be satisfactory, I'm sure Professor Craig will resolve. They also did, in keeping with the goal of commercial prosperity, want the federal government to have greater ability to regulate and allow for interstate commerce. They wanted union, but they wanted a union of the states. I think it's important to see they're all for the United States. It's sort of united, in a federal government, the Federalist perspective, or states is the emphasis of the anti-federalists. They were against the consolidation of power which they saw achieved through the federal constitution. They saw such things as the necessary and proper clause when combined with the enumerated power as a virtually limitless grant of power to the federal government. They thought that the ability to tax and spend for the general welfare would be abused to impose heavy tax burdens on the people and spent in ways that were not highly responsive to the needs of the people in the states. They had a pressing fear of the judiciary. Some, like Brutus, saying that if the legislature passed any laws inconsistent with the sense that the judges put on the Constitution, the courts will declare it void, and therefore, in this respect, our power is superior to that of the legislature, understood as the branch that represented the people. Likewise, they said that, you know, we are sowing more seeds of arbitrary government in the judicial branch by virtue of their life tenure, unresponsiveness to the people, than in any other branch. They, with respect to this new innovation of a divided sovereignty, which upon which the federal constitution rests, the anti-federalists were very skeptical. They said, you know, the mixture of sovereignty may exist for a time, but it will inevitably tend in one direction or the other. I think that we can see that many of these anti-federalist concerns have been borne out. Now, underlying that, the notion that the government, as constituted, the people through the Articles in the states, acting together through the Articles of Confederation, could be sufficient to achieve our national destiny. They had this notion of smaller republics as basically the best guarantee of freedom and responsiveness to the people. And behind that, of course, is the notion that our government, this United States, rests ultimately on the sovereignty of the people. This was, you know, one of the theoretical innovations or insights that drove the founding period. They thought that the republics, to preserve that civic virtue, responsive government to the people, and make sure that government in the abstract did not become tyrannical, had to be fairly limited in its scope. There had to be a fairly close relationship between the citizens and the unit of government that exercised the most authority over them. They wanted a small republic because they believed that made for voluntary and meaningful allegiance to the unit of government that held the most power over the people. They wanted a small republic and then a confederation because they believed that, you know, it was that smaller unit which allowed representatives to have a stricter identity of interest between the people that they governed and the common good. When those people came back from the state legislatures for their short terms, they came back to their fellow citizens and shared their circumstances. They couldn't help, therefore, but be apprised of them and sympathetic to the real needs of the people. They also thought that the smaller the unit of government, the more responsive the elected officials would be to their constituencies. And therefore, they saw the republic, a confederation of states, the people in the states, as more accountable to the people from whom sovereignty ultimately derived. They also saw in the small republic a better guarantee of a virtuous citizenry. The notion is when the union of government is smaller, there's more homogeneity in the populace, more natural sympathy between them. They also thought the states, by catering to the genuine needs of the citizens in the states, were making possible a broader property class which had the economic security that they believed was essential to exercise true political autonomy, not to become slaves to the sovereign. As so many had, they thought, in Great Britain, where the king had used his taxing power to take up a great treasury, which he promptly used to pay out to corrupt the commons, so that the commons frequently was more responsive to the king than to the people of the nation. So I think it's fair to say that most of the people looking at the anti-federalists think that they were more democratic in these ways, less elitist. They did look at the difficulties of the 1780s, but many of them tended to think that those were temporary instabilities caused by war and post-war disruption that would be addressed over time as the nation gained its own feet and began to move forward through the thrift and industry of the citizenry. They believed in popular sovereignty and the notion of government first and foremost through the states and only remotely and in a very limited sense to the Confederation was part of that notion of popular response, popular sovereignty and responsiveness. They believed that the further removed the seat of government was and office holding from the voters, the more likely it would be that they would be corrupted by their power and unresponsive. They agreed in principle, I think, with the notion of separation of powers, but they thought that the Constitution didn't have enough separation to truly affect its goals. So they looked at things such as the Senate advising and consenting the President on treaties or executive officers as not enough separation to prevent the unitary sovereignty that had been proven tyrannical as embodied in the King and Parliament in England. When they saw the President recommending legislation or with the veto power, likewise, they said, we're all for separation of powers, but we don't think there are enough. They were all for checks and balances, but they thought that the Constitution didn't contain enough by way of checks and balances. They thought it was better to give very limited powers up front and check the federal government's authority either to tax or to spend or take certain steps by the states having to approve rather than pursue the model set up by the Federalists, which was to grant the federal government that power in the first instance so that they could be energetic, so that they could, as the Federalists say, achieve its goals, and then have to try and, you know, close the barn door after the horse had left. So that's it. Finally, I mean, they were very suspicious of the whole notion of enumerated powers. For that reason, they said that, you know, they looked at the document and said, well, if the enumerated powers are truly as limited as you say, then why are there provisions that have to, you know, make sure they can't suspend the writ of habeas corpus? Why is there a provision that says they can't grant titles of nobility? There's no enumerated power that confers that right. So we can see then that this federal government you're setting up has a much broader sphere of power than you've told us. You've carved out these little things. We need to carve out a whole bunch more. So they are responsible, first and foremost, for the Bill of Rights. If you look at the Bill of Rights and its great contribution to the history of our nation, look and say, well, we've got the criminal procedure provisions to protect us from the abuse of authority they had seen in England. We've got the protections for speech and religion, which are so vital to democracy. And in addition, you can see that they have the 10th Amendment, which reserved power to the states. He says, stop, but I'm not gonna. I'd say this, the final thing that we can see is this. Should we feel sorry for the anti-federalists and think that they have no part in our national history or no lasting legacy? I think not. I mean, I think when you look at the way politics unfolded, the 17th Amendment, mentioned by Professor Craig, is a great example. The initial rationale was that the senators would represent the states as such, such that the federal government would reflect the interests of the states as such. In the late second half of the 19th century, you can see people said, you know what, that was theoretically a possibility, but it hasn't borne out that way. Rather, those senators are far removed from the people they represent. They don't represent the people as such, and they've been captured by corrupt interests. The response was, of course, the direct election of senators. And I think that that's one thing that we can see, a sort of legacy of the anti-federalists, a call for a greater and more direct democracy. We can see, you know, hallmarks of those in the Jeffersonian Party, Jacksonian Democrats. We can see them in the populists. We can see them in the progressive era reforms of initiative, referendum, and recall. You know, ultimately, I think that they're part of an ongoing discussion about the proper balance of power and the proper amount of authority and responsiveness to the direct will of the people. I think that in a real sense, there's no greater tribute we can pay to the anti-federalists than to recognize that as all of their worst fears have been recognized, as all the enumerated powers have been expanded beyond our belief and become the vehicle for precisely, many people think, the sort of tyranny and unresponsive government that the anti-federalists fear. That, you know, the anti-federalists have the great delight in what I think might well be a historical irony, which is to say that in our day and age, you can find perhaps no greater champion of the anti-federalist cause than the Federalist Society.
Thank you.
Let me say, first of all, I've been having the same nightmare that Professor Gill. When I reach for my gun, Hillary Clinton jumps out of the closet and says, "You haven't paid your tax on your ammunition yet," which is, by the way, in the stimulus bill. So all Federalists and Anti-Federalists would have voted against the stimulus bill last week, but there aren't that many of them. So we agree about a lot here. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But let me just run through maybe two or three disagreements about that I think are very important. The first one is on the Bill of Rights. It's certainly true that the most effective argument of the Anti-Federalist is the one that results in Madison promising various people who are opposing ratification of the Constitution and various people in various state ratifying conventions saying we should call another constitutional convention to address these problems. Madison assures these people that in the first Congress under the new Constitution, he will make sure a new bill is introduced. And so in order to head off a move toward the second constitutional convention, Madison agrees to that. It's a very interesting argument, and I'll just mention it and give you a reading assignment. I can't avoid that. If you look at Federalist Paper number 84, Alexander Hamilton has a wonderful argument here about why a Bill of Rights is a bad idea. He gives us three or four arguments in Federalist Paper number 4 about that. I don't have time to go through them right now. The other thing, the founders, they expected government to derive its authority from the consent of the governed. They expected the majority to rule directly in the House, indirectly in the Senate, the presidency, and the judiciary. But they disagreed very strongly with most of the Anti-Federalists. Most of the Anti-Federalists, their notion of representation, as Professor Gillen pointed out, is that government should be much more responsive to the people. So most of them were for annual elections, term limits, rotation of office, they called it. And the founders believed that while representatives should be responsive to the people, that they were supposed to represent not just the opinion of the people, but they were supposed to go, they're being trusted with authority, they're being delegated lawmaking authority, and they need to go deliberate. Okay, so the kind of representation that you see defended in Federalist Paper number 10, and especially in Federalist Papers number 62 and 63 on the Senate, is that these people are supposed to go deliberate about what the national interest really is. And that's not something that is available simply from public opinion, or, and this may be where the Anti-Federalists have been too successful, overnight polling data. The representatives are supposed to respond immediately to public opinion. Public opinion rules ultimately, but representation is supposed to refine and enlarge the public view in a way that it leads to the discovery of the true national interest in the making of laws. Also on the judiciary, it's certainly true that the argument that Brutus makes, I think it's in Federalist Paper number 6, Anti-Federalist 6 and 11, Brutus writes, his fear of the judicial power. Hamilton responds to this. Madison respond to all the Anti-Federalist Papers and arguments in the Federalist Papers. In Federalist Paper number 78, Hamilton discusses this charge about an out-of-control judiciary. You don't have to look at my handout there, but if you look at the quotation from Federalist 78 and the quotation from Federalist 48, you see Madison and Hamilton saying the most dangerous branch of government in a popular form of government is the legislative branch. Okay? The least dangerous branch is the judicial branch. Okay, he says the least dangerous branch is the judiciary. And what he means by that is when judges perform their proper role, as you learn from your Federalist Society, when judges perform their proper role, which is to say they serve as impartial adjudicators of disputes at law, in other words, they're like umpires at a game, they're impartial. When judges do their proper job, follow their oath, they are not dangerous to our liberty. It's when judges start substituting their will for the will of the legislature that you get judicial tyranny. So ultimately, the only thing that can prevent that, so what Hamilton argues is, yes, judges have the right to say that this statute is unconstitutional. Judicial review. He develops that argument in 78. Marshall plagiarizes it in Marbury versus Madison in 1803. He relies on Hamilton's argument. Okay, got it. And so what he argues there is that judicial review does not mean that the judiciary is superior to the Congress. Judicial review means that the Constitution is superior to the legislative branch, the Constitution is superior to the executive branch, the Constitution is superior to the judicial branch. And so judicial review is a way for the judicial branch to check the encroachments of the legislative branch. How do you ultimately make that work? Federalist Paper number 57 says ultimately it requires a self-governing people to demand of their representatives that they are true to the oath of office they take and that they uphold and support the Constitution, not violate the Constitution. So the ultimate check on government is the people will vote those rascals out if they violate the limits in the Constitution itself.
It seems to me, I don't have a lot to add either. I mean, this debate was had about 200 years ago, and we know how it turned out. I mean, the thing in getting ready and looking back over some of my old notes and so on, the thing that struck me the most is the way both Federalist and the Federalist relied on the virtue of the citizens in the final result for the greatness of the nation. And they really differed, I think, simply in how, as Professor Craig said, how direct the connection should be between the citizens and their government. As Professor Craig said, there was this notion, sort of a notion of statesmanship as opposed to what you might call just the direct reflection of the will of the people. That if you watch that argument work out between Federalists and Anti-Federalists, it's very interesting because the Federalists keep saying, yes, we concentrate a lot of power at the federal level, but the people are virtuous, they will choose virtuous representatives, and therefore the abuses of power that you're worried about are not to be feared in great measure. The Anti-Federalists take that and that's where they started, for one thing, and then twist it right back against them and say, well, wait a second, if the people are virtuous, then what do we worry about in the first place? Why don't we just let those virtuous people have a more direct say in the government of the states and then limit this federal authority, which is going to become more further removed and therefore more tyrannical. So, you know, I don't know. In terms of debate, I don't know if I have much more to say, except the Anti-Federalists certainly deserve a fair hearing as, I think, the voice of democracy and more direct government. And for better or for worse, that does seem to be the direction that we've gone in. The thing that where both sides have fallen down, I think, is whether we've really inculcated the civic responsibility, the civic virtue, the willingness to make sacrifices for the common good upon which both Federalists and Anti-Federalists agree, the whole experiment ultimately rests. So that's my closing. So maybe we do our part to inculcate that virtue, will have made some great contribution to the national experiment. That's it. I don't know. What's the format now?
This time we're going to open it up for questions. You can direct questions for either Dr. Craig or Professor Gillen. I ask since we're simulcasting, if you repeat the question into the microphone. Okay.
Question?
Hi, Charles from Southfield. Two questions. First, given the current headline about the White House trying to get reports from the Department of Commerce regarding the census, does that trouble you in regard to ambition checking ambition relative to apportionment? And number two, in the wealth of your understanding of the debates and even the mention at the time of our confounding documents, was there any discussion of whether the federal government should have control of gaming, adultery, marriage, the unborn, any rights to privacy at the time, which have now exploded as a federal right?
You want me to repeat that? Okay, the first question was about the census and how that fits in with ambition being made to counteract ambition. a great deal if they watched the way that was handled. I mean, basically, as I understand it, what happened was when Obama named a Republican to be Commerce Secretary, members of the House of Representatives, especially members of the Black Caucus, were very concerned about that. And so Obama said, okay, we'll just take that away. And so he, you know, what's happened, and then Greg says, well, if you're going to do that, I'm not going to be. And he said, well, I can't agree on a stimulus package. I mean, what's going on there? So, you know, there's ordinary, the founders understood that this ambition would include partisanship, that, you know, there's factions and interests. When men are free, they disagree. So somehow a sign of freedom is that's going on. You know, but the census would be, it's one of the few constitutional obligations of the federal government is to take an accurate census and count each person. And so that's gotten caught up with the idea that some people don't get counted, therefore we should make these models that are there. And the founders would find that extraordinarily troubling. There's no doubt about that. Now the other question, you know, the sort of hot button questions about abortion and same-sex marriage and gaming and all of those questions, I think all the founding fathers, without exception, I mean, Hamilton might be the one exception, but I think even Hamilton, it would be safe to say, that those are local questions. You know, those are questions for local governments. I mean, and local governments have an obligation to make legislation that leads to the protection and the health and safety of its constituents. And so that would lead to questions of defining a marriage and so on and so forth. And that's a legitimate obligation of government, but it's an obligation. It's not an enumerated power of the national government. It's something that's going to be left to the local and state governments and their understanding. So that's federalism. That's a question for local government. So I think in the end, you can see the most obvious example of that on a question such as prostitution or something like that. It's illegal everywhere in the country except for a few counties in Nevada. Okay, so federalism is a sort of recognition of the things we're agreeing to disagree about. And the most obvious one is slavery. You know, that we're going to leave that in 1787 as a question to be, you know, who is a citizen and what is the relation of non-citizens to citizens. We leave that to state governments to define that ultimately. Okay. Yes, Lee.
2 points. First, on the root point of whether these topics, gaming, adultery, marriage, and privacy, would fall within the enumerated powers as first conceived, I totally agree with Professor Greg that, Craig, forgive me, that they would not. You know, now, we have, the thing that comes to my mind is Indian gaming. Now, Indian gaming, I think, would, you know, because they were given authority over the territories, and so that, because it was within the scope of federal authority over the territories, could well, likewise, marriage and polygamy in the territories. Yes, again, because it fell within the sphere of activity that was entrusted to the federal government under the document, the initial document. The second and very interesting question is with the perversion, or say the limitless extension of the enumerated powers, chiefly through the commerce power, but also through the perverse use of the tax and spend power, then does the Constitution speak to those issues? And I think it does. If you look at, I think the discussion about privacy is fascinating, for example. One thing, as initially conceived, the Union, I think, would provide for all of those matters that could be seen as touching on privacy, simply being in the state sphere of authority. But once you have the perversion, the structure perverted, then the check is in the natural law, which was understood at the time to check all exercise of government authority, and the written Constitution, which was seen as another document that made more explicit in certain areas, not all, was not exhaustive, those checks on sovereign authority, and principally through the Ninth Amendment, which I don't believe is just ink blots. It was meant to do what it says, which is, you know, the rights that haven't been conceded are retained to the people. So is there, if you go to the First Congress, there's a very interesting quote by Madison when he's talking about liberty. He says, you know, man has the liberty to tip his hat on the street if he cares to. And his point is that the residual is liberty. It's the personal liberty. And that really this power is given to government. Simply, the Federalist argument was,
Power is given to government in service of liberty. It's checked by true liberty, so that theoretically, that government authority, even the authority to serve the common good, could never truly, shouldn't be allowed to infringe into the rightful sphere of autonomy of the person. So it's a sort of delicate theoretical discussion.
I have a question for you, Dr. Craig. I have a little bit of background in this era. I know in the last few decades in political science, one of the big discussions with Alistair McIntyre's Machiavellian Moment book is sort of the relationship between the traditional liberal philosophy and how much they're pulling from that more Republican, Plato, Aristotelian sort of format. So when I look at the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, I sort of see that dynamic. And I know traditionally they said it was all liberal, and now these guys are saying it's all Republican. I was wondering if you have a personal opinion on that.
I think that debate about between the liberalism and the republicanism, I don't think it's something that would make sense to, on their own terms, to the founders. I think it's an academic debate that sets things up in a way and then imposes it on the past that I don't think is true to the phenomenon itself. Okay, and so in the founders' minds, republicanism and liberalism, if you want to use that term, classical liberalism or the idea of individual liberty, in Madison's mind, what it meant to be a Republican citizen and what it meant to be a free man, what it meant to be a person exercising liberty, I think meant the same thing. And what that meant was that you were a self-governing human being, you know, that you your most important obligation, your most important right was freedom of conscience, your most important obligation was your duty to God. Ought to exercise that, but as a citizen, you ought to govern yourself, and that means you ought to govern your reason, not to control your passion. Okay? And so somehow self-government, what it means to be Republican, and what liberty means to go together. And there's not a tension in his mind between what becomes the libertarian position, I think, is not the same thing as the founders' understanding of liberty. And the Republican position, I think, sometimes departs from it as well in the 20th century, because what really emerges when the great corruption of American politics is in the progressive movement, Herbert Crowley, John Dewey, then Teddy Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, the Great Society, and then this radical left judicial activism is a notion of liberty that is a notion of autonomy. That man is liberated from any kind of traditional restraints, and the government's purpose to protect the idiosyncratic expression of that, whatever that might mean. And that means you can't limit someone's freedom to choose the right to marry however they want to marry. That becomes, elevates the choice to a constitutional right in a way that's a complete departure from the founders' understanding of liberty and therefore of limited government.
Again, I agree with the notion that their concept of liberty was ordered liberty, and the notion of liberty nowadays is licentiousness in terms of the language of the day. With respect to the difference in approach to political life between those of the sort of classical Republican tradition, which is a notion that a virtuous citizenry, because of its love of country, will be capable of self-sacrifice for the common good of the political unit, whether the state or the city-states of Italy and so on, as opposed to the liberal, more liberal notion of self-seeking. I think there is a certain touch point with the anti-federalist viewpoint in this way. Madison, I think a realist looking at human nature, like many people of his day, recognized that, you know, self-seeking behavior is often more the hallmark of our social and political life than any willingness to sacrifice for the common good. Madison sought to address that by pitting vice against vice, faction against faction, on the theory that the more factions involved, the more they would cancel them out, and the more likely it was that the product of the political system that they were erecting would be an end that truly served the common good. The anti-federalists did, at least some of them I've seen, had a fear that by embracing, as they saw it, and seeking to finesse this self-interest by making it a good. Remember, around this time, it's the parable of the bees, which says, somehow when all the bees pursue their selfish end, this is the view of the hive at the time, the common good, a hive filled with honey that keeps all the bees alive, is the result. Likewise, there's some notion of that that's running through Madison and other people as they're thinking, how do we construct a political life that that serves the common good but recognizes the reality of self-seeking behavior? The anti-federalists, at least some of them, saw that and said, look, you're making a virtue of a vice. And in so doing, by setting up the system, really, you're removing what should be our real drive, which is to inspire the love of country that leads to self-sacrifice. I mean, I got to laugh. I hear Obama's talking about, excuse me, the president is talking about stimulus and everything else. And the other thing he's calling for is sacrifice. Well, that shot seems way down range, you know. But that was the anti-federalist fear, that the way the system is set up for a blatant clash of interest, by accepting, legitimizing that clash of interest, we've almost repudiated what should be the real focus of our political life to instill civic virtue and self-sacrifice.
Great, that's all the time we have. Thank you very much.